Back in the 60s, when my wife and I were pursuing our program of study at Columbia, just up the street a few blocks, we used to attend this very church, Calvary Baptist Church, when the great Stephen Alford was the pastor. And little did I ever dream that I would stand behind this beautiful pulpit, one of the most beautiful I've ever seen in my life. But God has a way of surprising us and doing good things for us that we could never imagine. Well, I have the privilege, dubious as it might be, to be the first of the speakers. But I do count it a tremendous privilege and an honor, and I want to thank the committee responsible for inviting me to be here. And so the title of my address, The People, the Land, and the Future of Israel, according to the Torah. And of course, that's where it all began. There are two major parts to my address. I want to speak of events leading up to Abraham and descending from Abraham. And then I want to address the matter of covenants and how the covenants of Torah particularly fit together and how they point to God's plan for the Jewish people. Now, the Hebrew term usually translated people, that is, Am, though employed hundreds of times with reference to Israel, is virtually a generic for humankind and lacks the specificity that is intended when Israel as a chosen people is in view. Ironically, for that denotation, the word nation or goy is found about 35 times with reference to Israel out of 556 occurrences in all. So some of you Jewish people don't know that you originally goyim, but according to the scripture, that's true. Thus, Israel is not an amorphous people among peoples, but a nation among the nations, with all that that entails. This is important to keep in mind, for the eschatological gathering of Israel will not be as a people alone, but as a clearly recognized nation. Some of us are old enough to remember that historic event in 1948 when that became a reality in our own time. I want to speak first of all the promise of a people. The first attestation of Israel as a nation, that is a goy, is in connection with the Abrahamic covenant as articulated in Genesis 12, 1-3. Now, speaking to Abram, Yahweh says, I will make you to be a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you will become a blessing. Now, the full implication of this will be developed in a later place in my address, but for now it's sufficient to note the use of goy rather than am, the latter of which never occurs with reference to the Abrahamic covenant. Now we'll look at the lineage first of all, and before any single generation of a people could be fully identified and credentialed in the ancient Near East, it was important that its antecedent lineage be established. Where did they come from? Of what people groups do they consist? What has been their history of sedentariness and migration? What is their eponymy? Now, the linear genealogy of this passage, that is Genesis 11, notably, provides a clear answer to at least the last question. Abraham was the last of seven generations in a linear genealogy commencing with Eber. He and Eber included. The consonants of Eber, Ayin, Beit, Resh, are exactly the same as in the word Hebrew, except for the vocalic gentilic E at the end, indicating ethnicity or nationality, as in the form Ivri, a Hebrew. Now, spelled with vowels, the two words are respectively Eva and Ivri. Thus, Abraham was an Eberite, or in time and in line with the ancient versions, a Hebrew. As to other characteristics of nationhood, none applies in the case of Abraham's predecessors, except for consanguinity and possibly common language. Once you therefore refer to the Eberites or Hebrews as a landless, disparate, and scattered people who may or may not have had any sense of calling or purpose. Now, from Eber to Shem. The ancestry of Abraham is further defined as being transmitted via Shem, one of three sons of Noah. Only four generations are recorded between Shem and Eber. Thus, Abraham was 11 generations from Shem. Now, the name Shem, means name, to be understood perhaps as the name, the one paramount in the illustrious patrimony of Abraham. Abraham and his descendants would therefore be known as Shemites or Semites, since they descended from Noah through Shem. A Semite or Semitic is equally applicable to people other than the Hebrews, of course, the most famous being the Arabic line of Abraham's son Ishmael. The familial structure of Abraham's can be described as follows. Abraham was a Semite, one among one-third of the world's population, but more narrowly, he was also a Hebrew, one line among the only two lines descendant from Eber, namely that of Peleg. Now, going back still further, Shem to Seth, Adam. Of the three sons of Noah, Shem was designated to be the bearer of the so-called Noahic covenant, Genesis 9. A fact only intimated from the beginning but made clear as the descendants of the three sons of Noah at last centered on Abraham through Shem. After Cain slew Abel, Seth became the son of Adam, designated to form the ancestral line that would pass through Noah, Abraham, and David to Jesus Christ. 10 generations are recorded in the narrative, including Adam and Noah, and this is the genealogy of Genesis 5. But special attention must be paid to three explanatory notes that underscore the nobility of humankind and the need for its restoration to glory. In the first place, the writer notes that God created humankind in the likeness of God and then called them Adam or mankind. Second, Adam's son Seth is said to be an Adam's likeness, demut, an image. The same two terms are found in the creation story of Genesis 1, but in reverse order. The point is that despite the sin and fall of Adam and Eve, the image of God in mankind, though marred and distorted, still exists and is worth restoring. The third noteworthy statement comes in the naming of Noah at his birth. After the historical plight of humankind since the fall and the impending judgment of the flood, Lamech prophetically sees the day when his son Noah would become the means of bringing comfort and rest to the human race. Little could he know of the great plan God had for a line of Noah's descendants that would culminate in a deliverer who would usher in everlasting rest and peace. Noah, the prototype of the deliverer par excellence, is implicitly compared to Adam in that he would bring us comfort from our work and from the toil of our hands. Now, the latter term is found in the curse of the ground brought about by Adam's sin. In toil shall you eat of the ground, Genesis 3:17. The comparison with Adam is more explicit in the passage that introduces the Noahic covenant, in which Noah is commanded to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The identical words are found in the creation mandate to Adam, the implications of which I shall treat later. For now, it is sufficient to see that Abraham issued from Adam, the human race, via Seth, Noah, the second Adam, for my purposes at least, Shem, the ethnic people, and Eber, the patronym. The creation of a nation must await a time future to the patriarchs. Now, I'll stray into other people's territory a little bit here when I speak of the descendants of the people. That is, from Abraham to Judah and onward. The line from Abraham to Judah is uncomplicated, to say the least. Abraham, in fact, was the great-grandfather of Judah, the son of Jacob, or Israel. Both Isaac and Jacob had become custodians of the Abrahamic covenant. And the people of Abraham were in process of becoming a nation through the tribal stage represented by Judah. To him the covenant promise was bequeathed, and through him would come the messianic figure who would rule over all and, in a sense yet to be revealed, who would atone for the sins of the world. From the time of his naming Yehudah, let him praise, and thereafter it was clear that Judah, despite his failings, was the chosen vessel by which the redemptive purposes of God would be accomplished. The clearest indication of this sovereign election is articulated in the blessing by Jacob of his 12 sons in Genesis chapter 49. His brothers will praise him. Speaking of Judah, which is a play on his name, and he will be the one who takes up the scepter and staff, signs of his royal status. This rule will be temporary, however, for it will be surrendered at last to the one to whom it belongs. Now, King David certainly qualifies in the historical plane, as the Old Testament makes crystal clear, but beyond him exists one who is even greater than David, as he himself testifies. Now, a full discussion of this important truth must be delayed for now and until perhaps the next several speakers. Now, the descendancy of the people, this section will be treated only lightly since other papers do address post-Pentateuch times and texts in detail. But my justification for its inclusion is to demonstrate how the seedbed of Old Testament thought and theology was not stifled or truncated at the end of Torah, but to the contrary, blossomed and came to fruition in the remainder of the canon. The first canonical reference to the ancestry of David is the epilogue to Ruth, included there perhaps to demonstrate the inclusion of Gentiles, like Ruth herself, into the circle of God's saving grace. Beyond that, the genealogy identifies her as David's great-grandmother. Surely, an even more powerful sign of the grafting of those outside the Abraham-Isaac line into the wild olive tree of which Paul spoke in Romans 11. As for David, he was born in Bethlehem of Judah, and thus as a Judahite, fulfilled the ancient promise to Judah that it would be the tribe from whence the royal one would emerge. That Jesus was born in Bethlehem is self-evidently a claim to Davidic descent and to royal prerogatives. Now, the chronicler devotes more space to the genealogies of Judah and then those of David than to any other tribe. 99 verses in all. He clearly understood the messianic nature and separation of the tribe of Judah and of David, its most prominent figure. Beyond that, he is a central figure of the lengthy history of Israel and Judah compiled by the chronicler, 18 chapters out of 64 in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or 28% of the whole content of these two books. I ought to know because I've submitted a manuscript on Chronicles, on a commentary to Dennis Hillman, and Dennis sits there knowing full well that I've done it, and I'm hoping for some feedback from him before too long. But anyway, I plagiarized my own material here when I came up with those facts. So the focus narrows from Adam, Seth, Noah, Shem, Eber, Abraham, Jacob, Judah, David. Now, the descent from David to Jehoiakim consists of 14 generations and a period of about 400 years. David and Jehoiakim included. Now, for reasons of symmetry, 14, 14, 14, Matthew 1:17, Matthew omits the names Joash, Amaziah, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah. However, the lineage from David to Jehoiakim is not rendered incomprehensibly incomplete to the last of the Davidic monarchy before the Babylonian exile. Jehoiakim's release from house arrest by evil Merodach in 562 BC reignited hope in the exilic community that the house of David would continue on to its goal of ensuring return, redemption, and restoration of God's chosen people. Now, in summary to this point, two brief observations must suffice about this post-Torah record. First, neither the Old Testament nor any other extant literature records the genealogy preserved by Matthew. His sources are completely unknown, but his fidelity to the traditions of the preceding parts of the genealogy leaves no room to doubt his accuracy. Second, the genealogy of Luke's gospel supplies Mary's ancestral heritage, which, like Matthew's, also links David to Jesus, but through David's son Nathan rather than through Solomon. Thus, both Joseph and Mary were of the house of David, but through parallel lines of succession. Now, that's all I'll do with territory where I don't belong. Let me back up now and go back to the creation covenant, way back to the beginning, about which so much debate is occurring in these days, sadly in some evangelical circles where the historicity of these first 11 chapters is in great doubt or denial. And there goes our theology for this point. Though many scholars question the notion of a creation covenant, a case can be made for it, but I don't have the time and space to make the point here and now. I do have in some footnotes here some references that can be found support that point. What is lacking in this original covenant is the complete formal structure of a covenant document. But elements remain as follows. First of all, two parties are involved, namely God and humankind. Second, witnesses are present in the form of all other created things. Thirdly, there's a set of stipulations. Fill the earth and have dominion over it. And fourthly, blessings and curses accrue depending on covenant loyalty or disloyalty. Though lacking all the elements that normally indicate covenant genre, clearly in the nature of the case, the creation mandate is not between parties equal in stature. Hence, it is of a so-called sovereign vassal type. God dictates its terms, and humankind, as the inferior party, has no choice but to comply if it wants to enjoy the blessings of the relationship and avoid its negative consequences. Now, the purpose of the mandate is crystal clear. Man, as the image of God, is to exercise dominion over all other created things as God's earthly surrogate. He is not just in the image of God, he is the image of God, and therefore represents God, and in a sense, man is of royal stock, a king over whatever realm God places him. Thus, the notion of human kingship finds its roots. Now, the use of the term failure must first of all be clarified. Whatever God creates or initiates cannot fail. So any breakdown of the covenant relationship that might take place is the fault of man and man alone. Humankind was created with the ability to choose, as the text clearly attests. So his fatal choice to disobey his God brought upon his own head the judgment about which God had already warned. He surely died. Mot tamut. He will surely die, and he did. But even this seeming irreversible rupture of relationship could and would be overcome by the Creator. What he had created, he would recreate. Now, this brings into play the scheme of redemption and reconciliation that occupies virtually all the rest of sacred scripture. Its implementation would come about through a series of covenants God would offer to fallen humanity, which, if entered into and kept with loyal compliance, would grant new life and new hope. In fact, it would eventuate in a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells. Now, the Noahic covenant. The covenant text proper isolated here, and that's in Genesis 9, is embedded in a larger context in which God's promises of chapter 8 and Noah's prophetic outcomes to his sons in chapter 9 appear. The proposition that covenant is the instrument of reconciliation between God and humankind following the flood is clear from the fact that the technical term berit occurs in this passage 7 times in the span of 17 verses, a density of usage unparalleled elsewhere in the Old Testament. Now, the larger context may be analyzed as follows. First of all, God's promise never again to curse the ground, as he had by sending the great flood. Second, the original creation mandate reiterated to Noah, with an additional expansion concerning what could and could not be eaten. Man's original vegetarian diet now augmented by the consumption of animal meat, clearly a concession to creation's fallen nature. Thirdly, blood prohibited for consumption because it symbolized life and therefore could, in a sense, be eaten only by God in sacrificial ritual. Fourth, the concept of the sanctity of blood leads to the matter of murder by which a man's blood is shed. Since man is the image of God, the penalty for murder must be lex talionis, that is, life for life, but only as administered by government. Thus, humanity in general must be governed by law and must in turn exercise authority as an agent of God, Romans 13:1, where Paul says the powers that be are ordained by God. All of these principles and statutes are formalized and activated by the ceremony of covenant. Twice God says he's establishing his covenant with humanity in verses 9 and 11 of our passage. The verb translated established, cum, is the verb, but in the causative stem makim here, bears the nuance of keeping, as in keeping one's word. God, the one who cannot lie, pledges here to keep the covenant no matter what. Now, in the immediate situation, the Lord promises never again to destroy the earth by flood. And as a sign of his solemn commitment, he places a rainbow in the clouds. This he does, he says, still in highly anthropomorphic language, so that he, God, will never forget what he has promised. I think we take it as we look at the rainbow as a sign to us, but no, it's a reminder to God that he will never again destroy the earth. It's kind of a string around the finger of God. Now, following a drunken stupor, Noah adds to the covenant document prophetic destinies for his three sons in Genesis 9. First, Canaan, son of Ham, will be cursed, principally by his becoming a slave people. Secondly, Yahweh, God of Shem, will be blessed. Doesn't say Shem will be blessed here, interesting. And three, Japheth will not only subdue Canaan, but will find refuge in Shem. Now, as to number one, that is Canaan, no case can be made for African slavery, though Hamites did indeed settle in Africa. The text could not be clearer. It is the Canaanites who will be held in bondage. This began with the slave labor of the Canaanite Gibeonites, who had tricked Joshua into making a covenant with them and continued intermittently until no Canaanite survived. The blessing of Yahweh, number two, was in effect a blessing of Shem because it suggests that God would be with Shem in a special way, one we have traced earlier and found to center in Shem's role of covenant bearer of salvation. Japheth, thirdly, would be both large and small. It represents the Gentile nations that cover the earth but find their refuge and redemption in the tents of Shem, that is, in the line of Shem, from which would come salvation. Now, in conclusion to this part, don't get too antsy, the Noahic covenant reinstates the notion of divine authority mediated through humankind, even in its fallenness. Noah was, in effect, a second Adam from whom the nations would descend and through whom the original covenant mandate could be carried out. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is a, if not the, and I prefer the more definite article, central theological rubric of the Old Testament. Because first, it encapsulates in one man God's plan for the rehabilitation and restoration of his original pre-fall creation. Secondly, it, the Abrahamic covenant, engenders a fountainhead of blessing through a people who will both fill the earth and become narrowed to one descendant who will bring atonement and new life. And thirdly, it contains within it the promise of a people, land, and law that will form on earth a nation that ideally, at least, foreshadows the kingdom of God in the new heavens and new earth. Now, the matters of its literary form and conditionality or non-conditionality, though extremely important, cannot be discussed in such a brief treatment as mine. However, the premise of my address is that God made to Abraham an unconditional grant of land, nationhood, and blessing, with the ancillary privilege of being a means of blessing the nations. Moreover, this grant will never be rescinded because it is based on the sworn oath of a God who cannot lie. Now, if taken literally, and no good literary, hermeneutical, and theological reason exists not to, one should note that all three elements were fulfilled in biblical times. Israel occupied the land of Canaan under Joshua. David and Solomon greatly added to it territorially, and it was maintained all through the period of the divided monarchy until the Assyrian deportation of 722 and the Babylonian exile of 586. Even after that, the state of Yehud was formed after the exile, and an Israel was recognized in some form or other until the Romans put an end to it early in the 2nd century AD. Now, the promise of nationhood was slower in coming and was not a functional reality until the beginning of the United Monarchy under Saul, and then the elements of the promise were there much earlier in the tribal affiliations, but not in the structural sense that marked the transition from people to nation. Abraham's seed was blessed in numerous ways throughout the ancient historical period, and they became a blessing to others also in those times. This was evident as early as the Exodus event, as seen in the so-called mixed multitude that accompanied them in their escape from Egypt. These proselytes were clearly impacted by Israel's God and thus blessed in unimaginable ways, considering the utter depravity of Egyptian paganism from which they were converted. Examples of individuals are Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute, and Ruth, the Moabite, both of whom were grafted into the Messianic ancestral tree, to say nothing of the much later Naaman, the Syrian soldier, who confessed that Israel's God was the only true God. Even these manifestations of the efficacy of the Abrahamic covenant are eclipsed by the eschatological revelations of a future Israel with a future land, nation, and blessing. Glimpses of these things may already be seen in the modern immigration of the Jewish people into their ancient homeland, their formation into a nation among the nations of the world. They're blessing the nations through medical, scientific, and cultural enterprise. These foretastes set the stage for yet what lies ahead. The making of Aliyah will far transcend any historical examples. The nation will no longer fear their hostile neighbors, but will far outshine them. And the greatest contribution of all, their recognition, confession, and proclamation of their Messiah to the world, will transform the world as the nations also embrace the living God of Israel. I cannot see the time, lady, so I assume I have plenty. I'm near the end. Now, let's talk about the Mosaic Covenant. I leave that to last because that's the most complicated part of the whole issue of Israel vis-a-vis the nations of the world and the church. The term Mosaic, I think, is preferable to Sinaitic or the like because it suits both the Sinai and Moab versions and settings of the revelation of the covenant, that is, the ones found in Exodus and Deuteronomy, respectively. The major question to be asked of the Mosaic covenant is this: what is its relationship to the Abrahamic covenant and later to the Davidic, and I might even ask, to the church? These questions demand separate answers. Unlike some systems that view the covenants of the Old and New Testaments as sequential and on the same plane, I want to argue that in both form and substance, the Mosaic stands as an adjunct to the Abrahamic, in service to it as it were. So the Mosaic Covenant draws out the theological implications of the Abrahamic as they pertain to the identity and role of the special nation implicitly in mind there. Now, the narratives of Genesis and Exodus leave no question as to these matters. The nation in mind is Israel, the seed of Abraham that would be a blessing to those peoples and nations that blessed it. Now, one might designate the Abrahamic covenant as an ontological or existential entity that consists of the desire of our gracious God to bring the fallen world back into fellowship with himself without explicitly saying how. The Mosaic covenant, on the other hand, is a functional or utilitarian covenant that names the instrument that will effect this divine plan and instructs that instrument as to its several responsibilities in such an enormous enterprise. The secret lies in Israel's being a chosen vessel that will, by strict obedience to Torah, model to the nations of the world what the kingdom should be like. At the same time, it will be custodian of the message of redemption and the missionary responsible for its proclamation, as Isaiah makes so crystal clear. Failure to do this adequately will not ultimately frustrate the plan of God, for as Paul states so eloquently, because of Israel's transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles. On the other hand, quote, Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full numbers of the Gentiles has come in, and so all Israel will be saved. The Mosaic covenant may be broken by Israel, and was, but just as a natural olive tree may lose its branches and have wild olive branches grafted onto it, so it may also have its natural branches regrafted in due time. To this, the Old Testament also testifies in multiple passages. The Davidic and New Covenants lie outside the parameters of the paper and will receive adequate treatment by other participants in this colloquium. Conclusion, just one sentence, but it's a German sentence, which means it goes on and on and on, isn't it? Hear me out for this one sentence. I'm trying to pull it all together. Torah teaching on the land and the people may be summarized as follows, : God created all things for his glory, including humankind, his own image, designed to co-reign over all else, but man's sin and fall broke the connection, a rupture that could be mended only by an unconditional covenant pledge of restoration on God's part, the agent of which was the chosen people Israel, who for a time were set aside because of their covenant disloyalty, but who will be redeemed and returned to the land to carry out successfully the mission to which God had called them until Jesus comes to install the everlasting kingdom. Thank you for the opportunity to address you.